we're talking about the plausibility of the Torah as a historical document, and this is very important to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that the Torah has to be believable. It has to be plausible. It has to be sellable. Judaism is a religion that's based upon reasonableness and on logic. The Torah never requires us to believe anything that goes against what logical people are supposed to believe. There's nothing overly fanciful. There are no overly fanciful stories that are contained in the Torah that we're required to accept. Everything is logical and everything is reasonable. So we talked about the Torah as being a reasonable historical document, in that there seems to be a reliable transmission that is contained within the Torah itself. And the plausibility basically argues like this, that if Moshe Rabbeinu was going to present the Jewish people with a fabrication, then the fabrication that he presented to the Jewish people would never have been, never have gotten off the ground. It never would have been accepted. The Jewish people, if it was a lie, would have been able to see through the lie immediately. And he never would have been able to influence and convince the Jewish people that he was a real prophet. And now he's going to really sort of speak this out. So we're on the bottom of page 76, paragraph 48. And we're going to detail sort of this explanation. Looking for a reader today.
The Kuzari said, "This detailed narration of Chronicles in your Torah removes any suspicion of falsification or mass conspiracy. It would be impossible for even 10 people to conspire together about falsifying a date for the creation of the world to be passed on to their children without the collaboration ending in confusion. Eventually, the lie would be exposed. At the very least, anyone who would try to substantiate the lie would be disproved. And if this applies to just 10 people trying to pass on a date to their children, imagine how impossible it would be to proliferate a lie of this kind among an entire generation of people. Furthermore, the time frame involved is too recent for it to be believable. No such lie could succeed."
So Moshe is trying to pass on a lie. If he is indeed trying to pass on a lie to the Jewish people, somebody out of those few million of Jews that Moshe was trying to persuade would have come up with something and said, you know, especially we're Jews. There's always got to be someone who's going to disagree. Someone would have come along and said, come on, I mean, we know that that's not the way it was because we've had our grandparents tell us about history. I mean, the Jewish people were slaves, but they weren't mindless. They did have some kind of oral history that had been transmitted to them. Everyone has an oral history that's passed down to them from their parents and grandparents. So What you, Moshe, are telling us about the story of creation and the flood and the Tower of Babel, if this was all complete fabrication, then the people would have figured that out. Someone would have called Moshe on it. No one called him on it. No one said, how could it be? We've never heard this before. So this kind of history that Moshe chronicles up to his time is certainly something that they can relate to. Now, the next part of what we're going to see in the Kuzari is that take into account that Moshe Rabbeinu is encountering tremendous skepticism to begin with. When we look at the story of how he appears to Paro and to his own people, both Paro and the Jewish people are extremely skeptical of Moshe. So we have no reason to assume that he had this tremendous, you know, charismatic persuasive power over the people that was going to convince them that he was right, even though, you know, he wasn't like one of these really charismatic televangelists who is able to say anything and people just say, amen, brother, you know, we'll go along with whatever you say. Moshe didn't have that power. First of all, he was a stammerer and a stutterer like the Torah records. He doesn't seem to have been able to hold a tremendous amount of charismatic sway over the people. And the Torah itself testifies that people were extremely wary of Moshe, and they initially didn't really believe. And that was exactly what Moshe himself was worried about. He says, I'm not an influential kind of person. I'm not the kind of person that walks into a room and everyone wants to listen to what he has to say. Ki chavad peh chavad lashon anochi. Moshe himself says, I am a person who's got a heavy mouth and a heavy tongue. I don't really speak well, I don't really have that power of gab to be able to influence people. Why should the Jews believe in me? I'm a total stranger, I'm an outsider. And the truth is that even though the Torah records that initially, Vayamein Ha'am, that the people did believe in Moshe, the question is, what did he say that made them believe? And it has to be that he provided them with certain plausible statements, things that they were used to hearing, things that they knew about already. So when he told them that he had come to redeem them and that Hashem had appeared to him, there's this immediate kinship because people can relate to that. We see that he comes to Paro. Paro is very skeptical of Moshe. Mi Hashem Asher Shema Bekolo. Who is this God that I should have to listen to him? And yet, the rest of the world accepts that the Jewish people have this accurate chronicling of creation as well, despite the fact that Moshe is met with tremendous skepticism. So let's see how he details this, please. Paragraph 49.
The rabbi said, furthermore, Abraham himself lived during the generation of the dispersion. He and his family retained the language of his grandfather, Eber, and hence he acquired the title Ivri, the Hebrew. Moshe lived 400 years later when the world was replete with scientific wisdom of the heavens and earth. In this setting, he came to Paro and to the wise men of Egypt.
Hold on just one second. He's detailing here the connection historically between the story of the Dor HaFlaga of the Tower of Babel to the generation of Moshe Rabbeinu. There's about 400 years, he says, in the chronicling, if you look at the history of all the people that the Torah says begat and begat and begat, you'll notice through the number of generations and the number of years that everyone lived, there's approximately 400 years. Avram Avinu was 52 years old at the time of the Tower of Babel, according to our tradition. And that also works out, basically, if you do the math and you do the chronology, Avraham Avinu was alive during this time. Why was he called Avraham HaIvri? Why does the Torah call him the Ivri? You know, we're used to hearing the reason that he's called the Ivri is because he comes from the Eiver HaNahar, because he comes from the other side of the river. And he was known as Ivri, therefore, when he entered into the land of Canaan, and he was a foreigner. But there's another way to understand the word Ivri, which means that he is descended from a man named Eber. Who was Eber? Eber was the son of Shem, who was the grandson. I mean, Eber is thus the grandson of Noah. So the reason why Avram is called the Ivri for this reason is ironically just the opposite of the other reason. There are two messages about Avram Avinu. One message about Avraham Avinu is that he's the outsider. The Jew is always the ultimate outsider. We're known as the outsider, the person who comes from the other side. And there's a certain very powerful message about that, is that the Jew should always, in a certain sense, when he comes to a foreign land, always view himself or herself as the Ivri, as the Hebrew, the outsider, the person who comes from the other side. But for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that's not why he's called the Ivri. There's a certain power of that message, there's no question. But in this argument, just the opposite is true. Avraham is an insider when it comes to being able to use him as an accurate marker for history, for world history. He's known as the Ivri because he's just a few generations removed from the flood and he lives through the generation of the dispersion of the Tower of Babel. He's known as Ivri to create that familial connection going all the way back to Adam. So that's, for us, what Moshe is trying to describe, is that not that he's an outsider, but that he's part of, an integral part of the chain of history that goes all the way back to creation, to the times of Moshe. So Moshe's living in a time when people were aware of who Avraham was, that he was a direct descendant of Noah, that he had this tremendous influence on the world, and that he was living at a time when world nationalities were starting to coalesce in different city-states and different languages. And along comes Moshe 400 years later, so there's a collective history of this Avraham. There's now new science and new technology that has formed in the most advanced civilization of its time, which is in Egypt. And Moshe comes in this setting and he comes to appear before Paro. Paro, no doubt, has the same collective knowledge in history as the rest of the world does, that there was a story about the Tower of Babel, there was a flood, there was this idea about an Abraham that was the father of all of the Jews who came down to Egypt. Paro's no dummy. He knows the score. If he knows science, he knows technology, he knows architecture, he knows world history as well. So this is the reason why the Rabbi Yehuda Levi is presenting this. So it's in this setting that he comes to Paro and to the wise men of Egypt. Please continue.
Even the wise men of Israel scrutinized Moshe because they were not completely convinced that God would communicate with man. Only after they heard God's voice at the giving of the Ten Commandments were they fully convinced. The skepticism, even among Moshe's own people, was not due to a foolish desire to abandon God, but was attributable to caution born from wisdom. They were well aware that charlatans might claim to harness astral forces in order to try and fool the masses. Eventually, however, these types of chicanery, like fake gold, will not stand up to scrutiny. God's handiwork, on the other hand, does withstand scrutiny, since it is like pure gold, which only gets stronger after going through the cauldron.
So again, he's trying to emphasize here that you're dealing with the sophisticated people. You're dealing with both the Egyptians and the Jewish people. Were sophisticated. They were skeptical. They knew to recognize someone who was going to try and fool them through illusions and magic tricks. They were all well aware of these things. And that's why the Jewish people themselves were so skeptical until they came to Har Sinai. They were complaining and kicking and screaming until they come to Har Sinai. And then at Har Sinai, they truly have this sense of tremendous understanding and acceptance that God communicates with mankind. Thus, when Paro said, Mi Hashem Asher Shema B'Kolo, it's not that he didn't acknowledge that there was a God named Yud-Kei Vav-Kei that existed in the world. It's that there was no such God that he thought would communicate, this ultimate God over all that would communicate with human beings. That was not something that people were used to hearing. That was what was unique in this experience and this interchange that Moshe is having with Paro. Paro says, you're representing the God of all? Who is this God of all that I should listen to him? We refer only to the lesser gods that we can harness their power and communicate with. But this higher God is a God that no one has ever come back to us that they've communicated with. But it doesn't mean that Paro is unsophisticated. It means that Paro is very savvy. The Jewish people are very savvy, and they're skeptical up to the point where they can but no point submit to the fact that God is appearing before them because they have this revelation. Why is this important? Why is this necessary? In this context, it's necessary because, remember, don't think that Moshe was some charismatic a person who could pull the wool over everyone's eyes. People were skeptical to the very end, and therefore the only way he could convince people was through actual revelation and through providing them with a plausible account of the world as it had existed up until that time. So any account that we find in the Torah about the history of the world leading up to the giving of the Torah is for that reason alone is plausible. Otherwise it never would have gotten started. Continue, please.
How can one think that the wise people of that time could be deluded into thinking that just 500 years previously, the only language spoken was Eber's language, Hebrew, and that in the generation of Peleg, Eber's son, all the other languages cropped up in Babylon, and that one nation descends from Noah's son, Yepheth, another from Noah's son, Shem, and another from Noah's son, Ham, and that their respective lands were such and such? Is it possible that someone today could attempt to pass off lies to us about well-known nations, inventing things about their history and language that related to the last 500 years?
He's referring to the end of Parshas Noach, which talks about the story of the of Tower of Babel, and then describes how all three civilizations branched out. Noach has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yefet. Shem is the father of a Semitic people. That's where we get the word Semite, it's from the word Shem. But on a broader scale, Shem is the father of all the entire Caucasian race. Ham is the father of the entire black race. And Yefet is the father of the entire Asian race. Those are the three major races that exist at this time. They go off into the respective corners of the world. And this is essentially what the Torah records. If it didn't happen the way that Moshe said it, don't you think someone would have said, my oral history of how human civilization began is totally different? There's no reason for us to doubt the veracity of what the Torah records as far as how these nations came into being. Now, this is not a cornerstone of our faith. If a person says that I believe that Chinese civilization existed and formed in a different way from the way the Torah describes it, that person is not necessarily what we would deem an apikoros, a heretic. But it's just important to know that we have to just hone in on what the argument that Rav Yehuda HaLevi is making. The argument that he's making is that Moshe would never make a claim unless it was known to the people at the time to ring true. Why would you want to record something about human history and go out on a limb like that? There are no repercussions to the Torah. If the Torah had never recorded what had happened and how civilization began, human civilization began, that would have no impact upon the mitzvahs of the Torah that we have to perform. The fact that the Torah does record it is in itself a reliable sort of argument to show that the Torah is an authentic document, that the person who gave it to us knew what he was talking about, and that we can reliably trust that this, the way that the Torah records it, is the way that it happened. Now, is this an absolute proof? Can you say that this proves that the Torah's record of all things that transpired from the time of creation to the time of the giving of the Torah, this proves that it's 100% accurate? I don't know how you feel about it. You got to think about it. I don't think this is an ironclad argument. I think that it's an argument of plausibility, as I've said all along. And this is where people get into trouble. There's a whole website, and there's even a Wikipedia entry called the Kuzari argument, or the Kuzari proof. And there have been a lot of debates back and forth between a certain rabbi in Eretz Yisrael and a group of skeptics or atheists who argue back and forth about the Kuzari proof. I think we get ourselves in trouble when we invest too much in Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's so-called proofs. He's not providing here absolute ironclad proofs. He's providing arguments that suggest or that argue for the plausibility of Torah. Let's just keep that in mind. Okay, so let us continue. We're in paragraph 50. The Kuzari said,
I agree that it would be impossible. After all, we have books today that were written 500 years ago. No lie could ever be successfully propagated in light of the available evidence of the country's history and language.
Yeah, so I think that one of the counter-arguments to Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is that as human civilization became more and more advanced and more evolved, people's ability to record history became more sophisticated. So the argument that one could make to sort of, if one wanted to poke a hole at what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is arguing, is that one could suggest, well, just because if today someone were to suggest to us that 500 years ago little green men came down from a spaceship and gave us a 614th commandment, right? No one would be able to believe that because everyone knows what happened 500 years ago. 500 years ago, we were in the middle of the Middle Ages, and we know which king ruled in France and which king ruled in Germany, and we know what was going on in the Far East, and we know what was going on in Africa at the time, and the New World was just being discovered. We know what was going on. We have a lot of reliable history, and for someone to claim that 500 years ago there was a spaceship that came down with little green men, we would say, well, then why did we never hear about this before? How did this all of a sudden come into existence? So that's the plausibility argument that he's making about Moshe Rabbeinu coming to the Jewish people and to Paro and telling them that 500 years ago, this is what happened. The Tower of Babel occurred. Well, the difference is that in Moshe's time, there probably was not even a printed language in existence. If there was, it was a very rudimentary kind of printed language. The methods of parchment writing and all of the other things that became commonplace in the Middle Ages didn't exist back then. People were still engraving things on tablets in order to have any semblance of a written history of anything, a written record. And most things were transmitted orally at that time. So one might be able to submit an argument that you can't compare, 500 years ago from today versus 500 years ago from the times of Moshe Rabbeinu. That may be true for us. Remember, Yehuda HaLevi is living in the 12th century, so 500 years ago from his time was still in the middle of a really dark period in human history. That's probably in the middle of the, he's 12th century, so he's in the middle of the 7th century. And still, 7th century, that's when the Talmud was being recorded or being finalized. So Rabbi Yehuda Levi says, it seems reasonable to me that people would be able to know if something happened 500 years ago in his time or not. But maybe not so. Maybe not so in a situation of ancient civilization of a couple of thousand years before Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lives. You know, maybe that's not going to be the case. So you could poke holes in it, but again, it goes back to the plausibility issue, not so much to the proof issue. So anyway, so that's where he's coming from. So please continue with paragraph 51.
The rabbi said, agreed, for if this were not so, how is it that no one disputed Moshe's historical account, despite the fact that his own people and certainly other nations scrutinized his every word? The Kuzari said, fine, this point is ironclad and accepted.
Okay, and so that's, that he says, you know, that we're going to put aside for now. That I accept this, this is something that I can't dispute. It makes a lot of sense to me that if none of the Jews and none of the non-Jews who lived in Moshe Rabbeinu's time ever challenged his historical account, then there must be something to it. There must be something accurate to this record. The whole purpose of this exercise was not to prove the truth of the entire Torah, but rather was only to prove the plausibility of the account of the book of Genesis from the beginning up until the times of Moshe Rabbeinu. So just bear this in mind. If you wanted to make like a little note, it's that Ad Kan, up until now, we've argued for the plausibility of the historical record as presented in the Torah from the time of creation until the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. And remember the context in which we're making this argument. What is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi going to be arguing for? This is really all just an interlude to the larger discussion. What is the larger discussion? That the Jewish people are the elite chosen, and there is something ontological, something inherent within the Jewish gene that makes us different from every other human being in the world. And how did this difference begin? It began with Adam and Eve. That when Adam and Eve begat a whole bunch of children, they only had one child that had this unique metagene, superhuman gene, that therefore, out of all of their children, that gene was passed on to only one of their children, and that one child passed on to only that gene only to one of his children, and so forth and so forth and so on until we get to Yaakov Avinu and his 12 sons. And Yaakov was the first person who, instead of passing along that superhuman gene to one of his children, passed it along to all 12 of his sons. And that's the context of this greater argument, is that Rabbi Yehuda Levi wants to demonstrate that the historical account of the chain of generations, the chain of history going from Adam until Moshe, is reliable. It's accurate. And so when we find that this superhuman gene is passed down from generation to generation, that in itself is believable. And soon after we're finished with this, we're going to get back into that very, very important discussion, because there's a lot of problems with it, a lot of disturbing aspects to it, which we have to sort of work through. And so that's where we're headed. So that's what you should just keep in mind. We'll hold it for here.